Good afternoon. Ordinarily, Manish Parashar would have the pleasure of welcoming our distinguished guest, but unfortunately he cannot be with us and he sends his regrets. On his behalf, as well as on behalf of NSF and the Directorate for Computer and Information Science and Engineering, the Directorate for Mathematical and Physical Sciences, and the Directorate for Biological Sciences, I am delighted to welcome and to introduce Dr. Romy Amaro. I'd also like to welcome our colleague from MPS, Dr. Andrew Lovinger, who will be helping me moderate the questions. As is our custom at these events, Dr. Amaro will join NSF staff at 4 p.m. Eastern for a more free-form conversation. Please type your questions into the Q&A box, and Andrew and I will ask Dr. Amaro to respond to them after her talk. Dr. Amaro is a professor and endowed chair of chemistry and biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego. Her research focuses on development of computational methods in biophysics for pharmaceutical applications. She obtained her bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and spent 2 years as a staff scientist at Kraft Foods before returning to UIUC to pursue her PhD in chemistry. After a postdoctoral fellowship at University of California, San Diego, she joined the faculty at University of California, Irvine, with appointments in the departments of pharmaceutical sciences, computer science, and chemistry. In 2010, Dr. Amaro received both an NIH Director's New Innovator Award and the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers. She returned to UCSD in 2011 in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry and directed the National Biomedical Computational Resource from 2013 to 2020. I too am having Zoom problems today. Apologies. Dr. Amaro remains active in public outreach and science communication. A high school student she co-mentored won the 2013 Siemens competition in math, science, and technology, the 2013 Google Science Fair, and the 2014 Intel Science Talent Search. Last February, Dr. Amaro and her team were able to produce the first atomic level simulation of the full-length SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, which was published in the ACS journal Central Science and subsequently described in a number of press releases and released on Twitter in March. A second paper, co-authored with a larger team, including researchers at two Department of Energy National Labs, SDSC, the Texas Advanced Computing Center, and Rutgers University, entitled AI-Driven Multiscale Simulations Illuminate Mechanisms of SARS-CoV-2 Spike Dynamics, demonstrated the first all-atom simulation of the SARS-CoV-2 envelope, consisting of over 300 million atoms. The paper earned the 29-person author team the first ACM Gordon Bell Special Prize for COVID-19 research, which was announced in November 2020 at Supercomputing. Romy, I know you've had a busy day today. You've made a virtual trip to the UK and back again, so thank you so much for sharing your research with us today. To my colleagues inside the building and out, please join me in welcoming Dr. Romy Amaro, who will talk to us about the computational microscopy of the SARS-CoV-2.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy, for that.
Romy, take it away.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. I am really so pleased and so honored to be able to be invited to give this lecture to you all, this seminar today. And I'm looking forward to telling you all about our work to use computational microscopy to explore the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So some of you may have already heard about our work or read about our work in a very nice article that went to press in the New York Times in October. This was a beautifully laid out article that both in the digital form as well as in the print form, I'm sort of showing you two of those images here. And what this article did was it really showed the world how much scientists have been able to learn about the SARS-CoV-2 virus and its molecular piece parts. And the model of the virus that we built and simulated as part of our work with the National Science Foundation and a tremendous effort from this 30-member team that won the Gordon Bell Prize was sort of really sort of featured prominently as part of this article. And so what I'm going to do today is really try to give to tell you the sort of the story behind these images, the scientific sort of work that went behind making these beautiful images. But before I go there, I was also asked to give one slide about me, or a little bit of more of a personal reflection, perhaps on something that was important to me. And for this, I, of course, you know, there's, I have to say, I feel so fortunate for so many different things that have happened in my career. There's one really sort of prominent figure is Klaus Schulten, who I'm showing here. And there's this beautiful quote from him that says, my goal was to look with mathematical and computational means at the inside of cells, one atom at a time, to decipher how living systems work. That is what I strive for, and I never deflected from that goal. I love that that quote from him because it's really, it's so him, it's so Klaus. You know, Klaus was to me a mentor, a collaborator, a friend, and really a kindred spirit. And, you know, I think part of what was so meaningful about knowing Klaus was this at the end of this quote, this, you know, not deflecting from the goal. And I have to say, you know, the simulation of large systems, as I'll describe today, for Klaus in particular, you know, it took really an enormous amount of perseverance. Not only because it's scientifically difficult, not only because it's technically challenging, you know, how one constructs and simulates and analyzes these like huge data sets. I mean, you quickly break all of the machines and all of the programs that, you know, used to work for smaller scale things. You know, but also one of the hardest parts too is just culturally, in terms of, you know, that most physicists, biologists, chemists, you know, recognizing that this work is highly interdisciplinary, but most scientists in general tend to be reductionist in their approaches, certainly at the molecular level, just by design. And there's a resistance to the simulation of big systems. And, but, you know, Klaus persevered. And I think it was oftentimes hard won, you know, hard fought. And, you know, when I sought to do the same with influenza, which I'll just touch on briefly today, Klaus was someone who went from being a mentor to really being an ally. And, you know, it's so important to have allies, no matter what your career is, I think, particularly in science. And for me, he was really one of the most important that I've been sort of fortunate to work with. And, you know, he died suddenly, unexpectedly in 2016. That was right around the time that my own independent lab was really hitting its stride. And that was a very difficult loss. It was a big loss for the community. It was, you know, personally also very difficult. But, you know, I'm so pleased to be able to carry on his legacy and his vision. And, you know, I think the work that I'm gonna tell you about today, the culmination, at least partway of that, of this work, winning the Gordon Bell Special Prize for COVID-19, you know, that was, you know, really very special. And it was something that, you know, probably folks won't be too surprised to learn that, you know, we dedicated the work and the win to Klaus. So with that. So, you know, one of Klaus's central things was this idea, this concept that one could use mathematical models together with physics and chemistry and computing to explore those atomic movements of complex biological systems in ways that evade experimental characterization, to in fact use molecular dynamic simulations as what he liked to call a computational microscope. And personally, I love that analogy because that's exactly how we intend to use this. What we do is we can combine data sources coming from multiple types of experimental methods, many types of experimental methods, to develop data-centric, highly detailed data-centric models of complex systems. So we can combine structural data, multiple types of structural data techniques, such as cryo-electron microscopy, X-ray crystallography, and tomography, and together with mass spec data, genomic data, so that we can integrate faithful information about glycomics, lipidomics, and the genomics of the system. And what then we're doing is we build these highly detailed atomic level models, and then we're approximating that system down to its many atoms. And so all we're doing is defining a potential function that's shown here. And this basically describes the interactions that all the particles or the atoms in our system have with each other. And then we're simply integrating Newton's equation of motion over time. And so we're, you know, exploring the classical dynamics of the molecular piece parts of these systems. And we perform this numerical integration millions and billions and trillions of times in order to build up a dynamical understanding of our system over time. And we do this numerical integration. Importantly, you know, these are really computationally intensive methods. And so they require big computers. And so, you know, the work that I'll tell you about today, we were very, very fortunate to be really just fantastically supported by a number of supercomputing sites, including San Diego Supercomputing Center, including TAC, the Frontera machine in particular, Dan Stanzione being just tremendously important in these efforts, and also Summit at Oak Ridge National Lab for some of the sort of largest scale systems that we're running, also very important. And so what I hope to tell you about today is how we've used these data-centric computational simulations to go beyond what we know with experimental methods for SARS-CoV-2. And so, so you know, until about February of last year, my lab, the research in my group, we had been focused for a number of years in studying the influenza virus and the its glycoproteins. And so, you know, last February was a really sort of the special month for us because it was when this really massive effort that my group had developed over a period of about 6 years or so, starting in 2013, working then with Klaus, with his allyship, as I mentioned, but then carrying across a number of years, we finally published that work. And this work was published in ACS Central Science. It was featured on the cover. And this presented at the time what was really one of the largest biophysical simulations that had been sort of really studied scientifically. And so it had about 160 million atoms, and we were so proud to finally get that out. But it was around that time that, that SARS-CoV-2 started to catch our attention. And, you know, back in February, so what I'm showing here are the total confirmed COVID-19 cases as on log scale, as a function of time for the early months of the pandemic from January through mid-May of 2020, and then case counts in different countries. And so at that time, the United States in mid-February, the case counts were still very, very low. You know, maybe we had about a dozen or so, but we knew that the virus had already escaped mainland China. We knew that it had already started to look very bleak in the Lombardy region of Italy. And so, so this is when we started to really pay more attention, at least, you know, in my group to this virus. And again, that same week was a very important week. This was on February 15th, something else really sort of monumental happened. And that was that the group of Jason McClellan at the University of Texas Austin, together with collaborators at the National Institutes of Health, deposited into the bioarchive the first cryo-electron microscope structure, so near atomic level structure of the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. And the day that structure dropped into the bioarchive and this paper dropped into the bioarchive was when we really pivoted our efforts to SARS-CoV-2. And, you know, in general, just as a general comment, I'll circle back to this later, you know, the preprint servers such as bioarchive, medarchive, chemarchive have really played an important role in scientists' ability to really deliver enormous learnings, and throughout this pandemic. And I think it's hard to imagine. In some ways, it's very difficult to at once grapple with the enormous devastation that this disease has caused, which has just been really unconscionably catastrophic. On balance, at the same time, with trying to find sort of silver linings from this pandemic. And I think, the response of the scientific community being so strong, and the formulation of new ways to collaborate and so forth, which I'll also touch on towards the end of the talk, has really been part of that and been very important to the work that I'm about to tell you about. Okay, and so this is sort of a timeline of our work over the last year. And I'm not gonna go through every part of explaining the slide, but it's really just to sort of give you a sense for the pace and the complexity of the work that we sought to accomplish in the end. Starting from February, 2020, when the first cryo-EM images of the spike protein were made available, and then how quickly and rapidly we and collaborators, took up this data and began to build on it and compute on it and to learn on it and to apply new AI methods and to not only look at the spike protein, but how the spike interacts with ACE2 and eventually to build the whole viral envelope and so forth, and to get that successfully running. And this was, this was something that if 2 years ago you would have said that this would have been just unimaginable to think that anybody could have accomplished. And it was just only possible because of just a tremendous sort of collaborative effort from a number of teams. So today, in today's talk, I want to cover mainly sort of what are the scientific highlights that we've been able to learn. So what's the new science that we've been able to learn for this virus, and to give a sense for the type of advances that modern day computing, supercomputing, and many related algorithms and allied fields can provide. Okay, and so I'm sure all of you are familiar with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, as I'm showing here. This is an image from our group. This is one of the all-atom models that we've created. So this virus is a lipid envelope virus. It looks just sort of like a golf ball with spikes sticking out of it. And these spikes are in fact called the spike protein, or the S protein. And we and others are very, very interested in how this spike works, because it is, as you see, it sits on the outside of the virus, and it's the first point of contact that the virus has with human cells. So understanding the initial infection events really hinges on being able to understand what's happening with this important part of the viral machinery. On top of that, it's also highly antigenic. And so maybe, in fact, some of you have already gotten your first jabs. I got mine on Monday. All of the available vaccines that we currently have, two of them are encoding for the mRNA of this spike protein. And then the third one by Johnson & Johnson also utilizes the spike as part of its construct. So the SARS-CoV-2 initial infection, one of the really important parts that has to happen is that this spike protein has to interact with a receptor on the host cell called ACE2. And that stands for angiotensin converting enzyme 2. So this is a molecule that I'm showing here in yellow that sits on certain types of cells in our body. And this spike protein has evolved the ability to bind very tightly to this receptor. And it's this binding that happens, or this handshake, if you will, that happens between the host cell and the virus that catalyzes, essentially that really precipitates or initiates the infection process. And so, so in this talk, I'm going to come back. So I want to draw your attention to this light blue bit in the middle. This light blue bit is called the receptor binding domain. We also call that the RBD. This is part of the spike protein. And we're going to keep coming back to that, because this is the part of the spike protein that makes that contact with ACE2. And so there's a lot of questions that are sort of mechanistic interest in terms of, this particular area. Okay, and so Like many others, we were very excited to see the structural data come from not only the group of Jason McClelland, who was first to provide that structure. The preprint that I pointed to earlier was published in mid-March in Science. And this data was, you know, very, very important. It gave us the first look at the spike protein, the head of the spike protein. So the spike protein is a trimer. And each protomer, so each part of this trimer, so it's like three pieces that come together to form this molecular machine, each protomer has almost 1,300 amino acids. So it's rather a long structure. It's a big protein. And with cryo-electron microscopy, they can get a view of what they call the head region, which goes up until about the first 1,100 residues. This is what I'm showing here. And Jason's structure, they were able to resolve this RBD that I told you about, that receptor binding domain, in up or open conformation. So you can see how this little green bit is sticking up. A few weeks later, the also fantastic group of David Wiesler at the University of Washington published a study in Cell, which presented another structure of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, identical in some ways, or very close, similar to the open structure, they also, that Jason had presented, but they also presented a model of the closed spike protein that they were able to generate, not from averaging, but from symmetry. And so this also was very important to us. And so we took these two structures early on, and you know, in March, and we, you know, these structures. So cryo-EM is a fantastic technique. Of course, probably many of you know it won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2017, and it's just really sort of, they say, the resolution revolution, because it's really been a game changer, a truly transformative technology for the acquisition of biological structures, particularly those that are large and complex and have otherwise until now been recalcitrant to X-ray crystallography. But as powerful as this technique is, there are still things that it cannot see. And this is what we want to do with computing. We want to sort of give more insight into the bits that they cannot see with experiment. And this is, I think, this beautiful synergy that exists at this interdisciplinary interface between experimental science and computational science, but also together with physics and chemistry and biology and math. You know, it's really sort of, it's this, to me, that's one of the most fantastic parts, and I'll try to focus on the scientific message. I'll get back to it, but it's really sort of existing at this interface, which is difficult to pinpoint, you know, difficult to pigeonhole, but it's still so important for biological discovery. Okay. So we modeled the bits that they can't see. We modeled using sort of different methods, sort of standard methods. So we built in those missing loops, and we were able to complete or provide sort of complete structures of the up of the RBD up and of the RBD down states. But we wanted to, you know, we wanted to build the whole virus, and we wanted to understand how were all those pieces coming together. But, you know, the way to do that, you don't just start with the whole virus, but you actually have to, you know, you make models of the individual piece parts of that, of the virus. You make sure that each model is good and experimentally validated. And then you bring all those pieces together into the working whole. So part of that was starting with the head. So we started with the spike protein first, because this is where the data was, and we knew that it was important for infection and as an antigenic component of vaccines. So we started with the head, which we got from the cryo-EM, the head structure. But then there are other parts of this spike protein that I told you that they can't resolve because they move too much. They're too flexible. So part of what cryo-EM really has trouble seeing is if the bits of the molecule are moving around too much, it can't get a clear image for those parts. So that includes the so-called stalk domain, as well as the transmembrane domain. And this little bit that sticks inside of the viral particle on the inside of the virus called the cytoplasmic tail, which I'm showing here in purple. So we put all these pieces, we generated each of these sort of different, these additional parts that they couldn't see experimentally. And we generated in the end, this full length structure. So where we have all of the different domains fully represented throughout the whole spike protein. The other thing that they can't see in cryo-EM are glycans. And, you know, glycans are very important post-translational modifications. They happen to many different proteins. They are particularly important for viral proteins. And these are called, these are typically N and O linked glycans. So they're post-translational modifications that where there's an attachment that happens on either serine or threonine or asparagine. And it sort of decorates the certain residues of the protein, get sort of this extra decoration, this extra flourish of sugars or glycans. And so there's several different types of sort of sugar moieties that come off of these. And it, literally, if you look at this, it sort of looks like ornaments on a Christmas tree. We were able to rebuild the atomic level structure of these glycans, of these sugar molecules, using the data from glycomics. We used initially the data from Max Crispin at the University of Southampton in the UK together with Jason. They provided this beautiful study that gave the molecular recipe for each one of these each one of these glycan sites. So they were able to determine what the composition of those sites should be. Also, Peristu Azadi at the University of Georgia, she also provided useful data here. And so you can see sort of all the different components that we built in. But just to give you a little bit of a closer look, and this is really an eye chart. But so you have all of the complexity of the protein structure. There's some 1300 residues per protomer. But then at some of these asparagines, and in fact, there's 22 N-linked glycans and 2 O-linked glycans. So at 24 times 3 different sites on the spike protein, you have this extra bit, this sugar, and you can see that they're branched sugars. They have different types. And so they have different compositions, different linkages. And so this was the hard work. This was really hard work for us in March, in April, in May, making sure that this was faithfully built and that, you know, every atom is correct because, we're building, these are atomic level models. And so you have to worry about the chemistry. And you have to worry about, it's like you have all of these little decisions that have to be made, titration states and so forth. And we're going to bring them together in sort of a holistic picture. But it's, they say the devil is in the details. And this is certainly a place where it does get very detailed indeed. So for each of these trimers, you have this sort of extra bit on the spike that our simulations contain. Now we also needed to take care of the membrane. And so this virus buds off of the endoplasmic reticulum in the ER Golgi intermediate compartment. And thanks to many years of fundamental biological research, we know that the sort of the lipid composition of these different membranes, in humans. And so we modeled our viral membrane off of what was known. And so this is the molecular composition, the ratios of different lipids, including cholesterol, that are contained in our viral membrane. And so what I'm showing now is just, we're looking at the bottom part of the spike protein. So this is the bottom part of the spike. The slab across the middle is the membrane. And you can see the different lipids here. We're coloring those in pink and yellow and red and orange. And so you can see how they're all intermixed. But one more thing I want to draw your attention to is this highlighted bit in the middle. So you can see the protein is shown in gray ribbon, and you have this bit that's sort of going through the membrane. That's the transmembrane part. But then, there's this tail that sticks into the inside of the virus, and it has a whole bunch of cysteine residues. And not only that, but these cysteine residues have another type of post-translational modification. They are palmitoylated. And so these are basically aliphatic or greasy groups that are shown here. They look almost like little caterpillars, and they snorkel up into the membrane, and they help to anchor these viral proteins in the membrane. So our model has that too. We tried to make it as complete as we possibly could, given the information that we have. And so this is what we built at the end of the day. We have the full length end-to-end spike protein with all of the domains. We have simulated it in multiple states. We have the RBD upstate that I told you about. We also have the downstate. We have all the glycans, and you can see how many glycans there are, how it sort of decorates the entire end-to-end structure. We have the membrane with the different lipids and the palmitoylated cysteines. And this is what the fully reconstructed system actually looks like. And then we simulate it, right? And so we start to see how these atoms move and how they wiggle and jiggle. And, you know, like Feynman says, like all of everything can be understood at the end of the day in terms of the wiggling and jiggling of atoms. And so that's sort of in the spirit of these methods. But I want to emphasize something. This is more than just graphics. These are more than just pretty pictures. And it's not a video game, right? These are molecular dynamic simulations. This is numerical statistical mechanics. And so what that means is that the trajectories or this motion that we're predicting is done in accordance with rigorous theoretical laws to, of course, to some approximation. But what's powerful about this is that it allows us to extract from these microscopic properties, we can extract back out macroscopic, experimentally testable predictions. And that's what is the power of these approaches, that it is not making pretty pictures, but it is actually giving us information that we can turn to our experimental collaborators with new hypotheses and to help drive science forward. And so so these simulations that we ran, they had, as I told you, multiple states. We had 1.7 million atoms in these initial spike protein simulations. They have water molecules there and sort of ions in the buffer, but I don't show you that because if I show you all the waters, you can't see the protein, and most people are interested to see the protein. So we're hiding all those waters. For this work, we were able to use the CHARM-36 force field using NAMD2 on Frontera, and we ran on 256 nodes. So one of these simulations is sort of, you know, mass is parallelized, spatially decomposed to run very efficiently over, you know, a set of nodes on each of these architectures. And we were able to get 60 nanoseconds a day. So we ran for some amount of time. We were able to gather about 4 microseconds of data for each system. And what did we learn? Well, one of the first things that we learned, which was really, I think, so exciting, was we showed people what the spike, the full length, fully glycosylated spike protein actually looked like. And so on the left, what I'm showing is a picture of the spike protein, but just showing the protein. And essentially, this is what cryo-electron microscopy sees. It sees the protein. And that is, of course, super valuable, but it doesn't tell us the whole picture. So on the right, you can see the dark blue bits are those glycans. And so you can see how different the spike protein looks if you could see those sugars. And, you know, it's not only, so what I'm showing here, each of those blue puffballs or little like tufts of fuzz, that's the composite image of one particular glycan and sort of like looking at its snapshot over a microsecond of dynamics. And so what becomes so clear is how these glycans in their ordinary dynamics at the small scale, they're very, very flexible, and they will sweep over large regions of the protein and literally create a shield. And why this is so valuable is because for the virus perspective is because, you know, our human cells also have sugars on them. And so these viruses have evolved the ability to mask themselves or hide themselves with these very same sugars that our human body has. And in doing so, when the virus is inside of our system, if it's hiding, it's doing a tremendously good job at hiding this viral spike protein, which if the immune system could just see the protein, it would be able to recognize it as a foreign antigen and go after and attack it. But when it's hidden under sugars, it's much, much harder for that to do, for that to happen. So this was really cool to see. And so, you know, this was sort of well received. And I'll also just say, you know, it's not only where the sugars are, but where the sugars aren't. Because if we know where the sugars are not, we can think about, you know, how to design novel drugs, for example, that could bind into these sites, or it could be informative for future vaccine design. So there's all sorts of like fallout from this knowledge. Our simulations also showed why the spike has this upstate and the downstate. So until we came along, you know, people saw those, the upstate and the downstate, but there was no explanation for really why this movement had to occur. But when one thinks about the sugars, you see so clearly why this protein has to undergo these transitions. And that's because if you look at the closed state, so I'm showing the closed spike on top, looking like down at the barrel of the spike. And then on the right, I'm showing the open state. The closed state, you can see how effectively this spike protein uses those glycans or those sugars to hide the part of the protein, that RBD, that receptor binding domain. You don't see it very well at all. You can see tiny bits of it, but you mostly don't see it. And that's the part that needs to make that handshake. But in contrast, look at the open spike. With the open spike in that up state, you see a totally different picture of the RBD. It's completely exposed. And this is the bit that needs to make that handshake. So we would say, instead of calling this up and down, if it could have known about the sugars at the time when they were first naming, they would have called it a defending mode and an attacking mode, or a shielded mode and an exposed mode. You know, but these are the type of things that we learn over time. So this was also sort of a very nice result. Of course, at the end of the day, when we run these simulations, we save basically what we call trajectories, or those iterated atomic level positions, or integrated atomic level positions over time. And so it's just like enormously rich data sets. And there's so many ways that they can be analyzed. So one of the first things that we did was really sort of look at what we call the accessible surface area. So we wanted to basically quantify how much of the viral protein surface was actually exposed at any given time, and how much was sort of shielded. And we did that over various probe radii, okay? And the reason why we look at different probe radii is because if you are, for example, a water molecule, you're small, right? And it's going to be much easier for you to access these little crevices. You know, you're more nimble in that sense. Larger molecules, such as antibodies, it's a different story. You know, they're going to need larger patches to interact with. And so, you know, understanding what are sort of these average properties for these different components for binding, you know, is something that that these simulations have also provided. We did that for the head, and we also looked at the stalk. And why we care about the stalk is because the stalk is among the most conserved bits of the spike protein. If you look across the beta coronavirus family, you know, in other viruses, it's one of the places that people are currently looking to develop broadly neutralizing antibodies, or, you know, so-called universal vaccines. So there's a lot of potential there. But what you could see here is that this is very well shielded. And so this degree of shielding could hamper, you know, those efforts. Although, you know, there are moments where, you know, there is exposure and so forth. And so, but these simulations can help us understand these sorts of features. The other sort of thing that we can do with these types of simulations, of course, that there's a lot of interest in, is trying to take the structural information and also understand or map where the antibodies are binding, you know, so-called neutralizing antibodies. And this is a rather old picture now. There's been so many studies on where neutralizing antibodies are binding, but just to give you a sense for the kinds of things that one can do, we mapped on our structure. So the spike structure in white, and the glycans are shown in dark blue. And then we mapped different types of antibodies. We mapped where they actually bind to the structure. So there's a whole bunch of neutralizing antibodies that bind that RBD in the up state. So there's the B38 antibody, 47, D11. These are receptor binding domain antibodies. There's a lot of those. There's an antibody that's sort of very interesting. It's this cryptic antibody 3022. This actually binds in sort of the underside of the RBD. And in fact, one would need multiple of those RBDs to be open to gain access to that site. We now know that the N-terminal domain, which sits sort of adjacent to the RBD, is also a super antigenic site. A lot of antibodies targeting the N-terminal domain. One of the first examples was 488 that I'm showing here. But so this was the shielding, and there's a lot that's interesting about shielding, and that's typically how people until now really have thought about glycans. But we noticed something else. And we noticed something very interesting that, and this was, I have to say, a wonderful collaboration with Lisa Fada at Maynooth University in Dublin. She is a fantastic glycobiologist, glycochemist. And, you know, as, you know, we, early on in this pandemic, I'll talk about this more at the end, but, you know, we realized how much we needed to collaborate with other scientists. And she was one who was really important for us, one particular collaborator. But we realized when we were building the spike protein, something we noticed was that when we built the closed protein, what we saw was that this one particular glycan at position N234 was sort of always sticking out in solution. Okay, so it was always sort of sticking outwards in the closed state. When we looked at the open state, what we noticed was that the glycan, that glycan was sticking out in two of the chains, but in one of the chains, it was sticking in. And so we took a closer look and we realized that when we rebuilt the glycan side chain, so as I mentioned, cryo-EM, they can see the protein. And so I'm showing here in red surface and gray and blue, that's the spike protein. We're looking at the top head. This is that receptor binding domain. The cryo-electron microscopist can see the first sugar unit here. This is a GlcNAc in this case. They can see that in dark blue I show. In green is what we built in. And when we rebuilt that sugar side chain using simulation, what we saw was that it filled up the void space that was made when this RBD lifted up. And so this was very curious to us. And we said, well, what if we delete those? What if we, and by delete, you know, I'm thinking like a computational person, I say delete. In biology, we say we could mutate it. We mutated these to alanines. If you make this asparagine an alanine, it's no longer going to be glycosylated. So we eliminate the sugar at that residue. And so we did that in silico first to see what would happen. And we saw, what we saw was that this, a prediction that this binding domain, this RBD, when it doesn't have those sugars there, was going to collapse down. And then we called, I called up Jason McClellan, who I'd never collaborated with before. And I figured he was very busy doing vaccine stuff because he's one of the co-inventors of on the Moderna vaccine. And I just said, hey, we have this hypothesis about these two glycans. Sounds a little weird, but what do you think? And so he agreed to run the experiments. So he did those same mutations in the lab. And he created an assay, a bilayer interferometry assay that sort of looks at, quantifies the interaction between ACE2 and the spike. And what he saw substantiated our hypothesis was that in fact, when you make these mutations, he did the single point mutations, but when you make these mutations, it reduces the ability of the spike to interact with ACE2. And our explanation of that mechanism is because it's actually, when you remove that structural scaffold, that RBD collapses down and then becomes unavailable for binding of ACE2. So that was really nice. This work was cool because, you know, not only did we begin to understand the extensive shielding of this protein, but we showed for the first time for any viral protein that we know of, actually, a new role for glycans in biomolecular systems. And that's that they're actually, what we showed was that these two glycans were actually participating in the structural dynamics in the mechanism of the viral weaponry itself. And that was very cool. So this work was published in ACS Central Science, has been very, very well received. And I think it's really providing sort of like a new insight into the biological phenomena, essentially like of sugars, you know, their roles and their mechanisms in biology. Very cool. Okay, so, but what else did we do? So, you know, that was just to start. So with standard or conventional molecular dynamics, one of the big challenges is that, you know, it's very informative, like I just showed you, where we can sort of use MD to sort of explore the baseline dynamics, I like to call it, around particular states. So we took their closed state and we let it wiggle and jiggle and we saw something, and we took the open state and, you know, we did something else. But if we want to actually see that functional transition of going from closed to open, very, very, very hard with MD, especially for systems that have this sort of size and complexity. So We partner. So what happens in standard MD is that you spend a lot of time waiting for things to happen. You're running, and you're waiting. Lillian Chong at the University of Pittsburgh became another collaborator of ours. She's developed this wonderful method called weighted ensemble molecular dynamics, which focuses on trying to be more efficient in terms of simulating functional transitions. And so you spend, using her method, it allows us to spend much less time waiting and actually do a better job going up these, to these interesting places on the energy landscape, which are accessible in sort of normal room temperature dynamics or body temperature dynamics, but they just, it's like a waiting game in terms of them happening. And so we used her method. It's called WESPA. It's a simulation program that has been, she's been working on for a number of years. We use that to study the opening of the receptor binding domain to go from the closed to the open conformation. And for this, we used a slightly truncated system model for the head. We didn't include the stalk. We just had the head, which was still really large. It had 600,000 atoms. This is the biggest simulation that they've, largest, most complex by a very large degree that they've used for this method. That's why we put a little crown on it here. We ran, in this case, instead of using Frontera, we used another machine at Texas, which is called Longhorn, which is just a big GPU farm. So we took over 100 of these NVIDIA V100 GPUs for several weeks. And using her method, we were able to generate, actually, this is outdated now, but we were able to generate over 300 of these opening pathways. And just to put this into perspective, if we wanted to use standard molecular dynamics or conventional classical molecular dynamics to see that opening, it would have taken us on the order of 10 months to 8 years using just conventional approaches. So you can see this would be, you know, going from just taking way too long to actually being tractable in a realistic amount of time. And so this is what we saw. So, it froze in the last one too. I don't know what's wrong with this guy, but I'll show, there's another movie where we'll see it again. But so we were able to sample that close to open transition. And that includes, so why we care about this is that we get 300 of these opening pathways. And now we can really sort of see what are the mechanisms, the atomic level mechanisms that this spike protein uses to open. So part of what excites me, as you can probably tell, and others, a lot of others, you know, is really sort of like understanding how these amazing molecular machines actually work. You know, how do they do all of these phenomenally interesting jobs, you know, in the cell? And so this is the kind of method that lets us see down to the many atoms, like how this is actually happening. And so we can do these detailed analysis of looking at salt bridges forming and hydrogen bonds forming and sort of like what's happening along the opening pathway. And one of the really interesting things that we saw was another glycan, which we initially didn't pay much attention to, because when we just looked at the open and closed states, we didn't see anything particularly interesting about it. But when we look at the opening pathway, we saw that there was one glycan in particular, N343 now, that actually acted like a gate. Initially, this residue is sort of helping to cover and shield part of the RBD. But then under just normal dynamics, there's no forces, no perturbations. This guy starts to like do hand jiving with the other residues near it, and it lifts the RBD up. And so we went back to Jason and we said, we have another crazy hypothesis. And he said, well, let's test it. And they tested a whole bunch of different mutations that we predicted and showed actually that this 343 is even more important than the other two in terms of governing the other two that we had previously found, glycans, in terms of affecting the conformational dynamics of the spike, in particular, the opening mechanism. So this work is currently under review. Okay, and then going beyond, I'm sorry, I'm going too slow. I'm going to speed it up. I really will. So then going beyond this, you know, we're interested in so many other things, as you can imagine. We have simulated also the ACE2 receptor, and I'm showing that here in the membrane. And one of the really interesting things that we found here was that ACE2 has an enormous degree of flexibility relative to the membrane. And this is something I don't think anybody expected to see. You know, we kind of always think about these proteins standing upright and being sort of very tidy and well-behaved, but it's actually waving around, undergoing like a very large degree of tilt. And it turns out we think that actually this sort of degree of tilt helps to facilitate sort of all of the different mechanical changes that need to happen in order for the viral and host cell membranes to fuse, because these proteins, they start like this, but then there's this huge conformational arrangement as the viral membranes fuse during the first part of infection. So what we did with the weighted ensemble is actually get a picture of how this RBD opens. You could see that opening finally. I'm sorry, my other movie didn't work. But once it's open and in that up position, it can then make contact with ACE2. And we have simulations that actually have this interaction of the two proteins across the two parallel membrane system, where we're really interested, of course, to look at the contact, what's happening in here at this interface, but also there's so much else to see. There's an enormous degree of stalk bending. And here, one of the interesting things we did for the Gordon Bell was actually use an AI-driven sort of multi-scale approach to learn dynamics from the weighted ensemble and from the conventional MD at the single protein scale to then help drive conformational sampling of these different molecules in larger and more complex scenes where we otherwise will be even more limited because of the increase in the number of atoms and the complexity of the landscape. So I don't talk about that much in terms of the technical details for the AI. There are some in the Gordon Bell preprint, but we're working to write that up now. This was a great collaboration with Arvind Ramanathan at Argonne National Lab, together with Shantanu Jha at Rutgers. But what we could see is really that there are these flexible hinges in the spike stalk in particular. And this corroborated studies by Humer as well as Martin Beck at the Max Planck that showed a large degree of tilting in cryo-electron tomography and also simulation studies that they published late last summer. And so we can use these approaches to try to, again, sort of sample what's happening with these dynamics. But we've been very interested to develop models of the entire virus. And so, you know, the single biggest obstacle to the simulation of structures at the scale is building a membrane that's good enough for simulation. And that's because of differences in the inner and outer leaflets of these membranes causes a lot of small issues to happen with the positioning of these atoms. And so we had to develop an intensive iterative sort of membrane remodeling process such that we could get everything cooperating in some sense so that it's numerically stable when we go to simulate it and still biologically accurate. And we were able to do this in time for the Gordon Bell submission and actually simulate the full viral envelope with molecular dynamic simulations. We did this pilot runs on Frontera, and then we moved to Summit for production, and we showed really nice scaling of the NAMD2 code. And with this model now ready to go, it's like it opens entirely new dimensions for studying viral infection and therapeutics, and also something which I don't have time to talk about, but I'm intensely interested in, is in understanding elements of airborne transmissibility and what happens to these viruses when they're in aerosols. And this is a place also, you know, the study of aerosols and the chemistry of aerosols. I realize chemistry is not one of the co-sponsors of this seminar, but this is really integral, is sort of like there's a lot of development to be done in terms of experimental methods that atmospheric chemistry and physical chemistry types need to develop. And we're doing that now hand in hand with folks in various investments and other, I guess, portfolios of the NSF. But this is something else where I think simulation has a tremendous place where it has a lot to give. Okay, and so I have to give a shout out to, there was really just an incredible almost 30 member team that participated in these Gordon Bell activities, which we won that special prize, Gordon Bell uh, uh, contest or prize, whatever, in November, which was really cool and just like an incredible, incredible effort. And of course, it was sponsored by so much support from the National Science Foundation and by TAC and others. So it was really great. And this was also an international collaboration. We also worked with the UK for parts of this model, which was really important. Okay, and then I think I'm probably like out of time. I've gone too long. I apologize for that. But I did want to say, you know, these simulations also can give us the first glimpses of what happens to these proteins when they undergo mutation. So of course, there's been a lot of discussion about how these the spike protein and the virus in general is mutating as it circulates in these populations. And this is probably going to at some point cause real trouble for the current vaccines. Moderna just announced yesterday they have, you know, put out a new potential variant formulation for the vaccine, update to the vaccine for the South Africa variant. And we can, you know, use these computational methods to assess sort of what are the structural changes and just to predict, you know, like how much we should potentially need to be concerned for different mutations. We're doing that also. And then I just want to say, you know, it's been such a special time to be a scientist. Again, one of sort of like the silver linings or the bright spots of the pandemic, I think, has been just the tremendous response from the scientific community. Early on in the pandemic, a colleague in the UK, Adrian Mulholland, and I realized that we needed to do something very different. You know, ordinarily we would build these models and our models and our simulations, and we always hold our cards sort of close to our chest because science rewards people being first. And so there's some degree of the incentive of the system being to not share. But we realized that this was very different than anything that any of us had ever confronted before. And we would need to do something different in terms of how we operated as a scientific community. And so in March, we drafted a set of principles that nearly every molecular simulation group in the world committed to. And this included the use of preprint servers, fair data, sharing of systems, and just all of that. It led to the creation of the COVID-19 Molecular Structure and Therapeutics Hub, which is another NSF-sponsored sort of investment in molecular simulation. And this now has tons, it's like a clearinghouse for simulation data, systems, methods from all over the world. And anybody who's interested can, you know, can go there to grab models and continue to work on them and further embellish them and to analyze them. And this is going to be, I think, a tremendous resource for AI-driven methods in the space of SARS-CoV-2. It's just the amount of data here is just remarkable. Our data set, for example, and the sharing has been fantastic. Our data set that we made on Frontera has been shared over 4,000 times by various academic groups, industrial groups. So we've been able to really sort of amplify the impact from this work. And I think that's been really great. I also just want to say, you know, how important it is that we have well-developed community codes. You know, this is the hard work of people like Klaus and others who carry it forward, who have ready, at the ready for scientists to be responsive, these excellent codes that, you know, it requires investment in these things such that we're prepared to use them immediately as soon as, you know, the next thing hits, or hopefully in advance next time we'll be more prepared. But just want to emphasize really the importance of community software and open access in this space. And then also, of course, the HPC Consortium for COVID-19. What a tremendous gift for scientists in this space. You know, ordinarily it would take 8 months to a year to get compute time. One puts together a proposal, the proposal is reviewed, eventually it gets allocated. In this, for big simulations like the whole virus, that could take years. It took us 3 years to get compute time for influenza. After it was built and ready to go, we still couldn't get time. But we did eventually, and that was great. And with SARS-CoV-2, however, you saw how quickly we got access to it. It was like, that was amazing. And I think this has been sort of the whole mobilization, the agility of the scientific community and kind of all aspects of that. It's just really one of the silver linings of the pandemic. With that, I will stop talking and we can have questions. I hope I didn't go so long that we don't have time for questions. But I just wanted to thank the acknowledgers. It's been, like I said, it's a huge team with tremendous contributions, so many sleepless nights, so many preprints. I mean, it's just like keeping pace with everything has been It's been difficult and exhausting, but also so exciting and just fantastic at the same time. And so I just want to thank also NSF for support, early support on this project in multiple ways. You know, MCB sponsored this as part of a rapid, and also the compute infrastructure, which is just some of the best in the world. So with that, thank you. And I'm happy to, you know, discuss and take questions.
Everybody, if you can, find your symbols that indicate applause. A couple things, as Andrew pointed out, chemistry is a co-sponsor of this. Chemistry is part of
mathematical and physical. Oh, they are, yes. Oh, gosh, I'm sorry. I do know that.
Is with us from the chemistry division, so it's okay. The chemists are our friends, too. I also want to acknowledge Alan Tessier and I believe Joanne Torno from the Director of Biological Sciences, who are co-sponsors of this, as we said early on, but they are here. And we do have a number of questions, and I believe we have 30 minutes for conversation, and I get to mute and go dark because Andrew is going to lead off with the questions. Okay. Carry on, Andrew.
Well, you're muted.
Andrew, you're muted. Andrew, the mute button is the hardest
one. Yes, thanks very much. And really, this was a fascinating and inspiring lecture, one of the very best we have had. So the first question talks about the holistic atomistic detail simulations that you have provided. And the questioner is Amar Dashe, who is asking, do you still think there is a role for researchers who take the more reductionist approach and still investigate coarse-grained or multi-scale approaches, so models, scoring functions, or even AI and ML researchers that skip the molecular dynamics platform and instead employ other approaches to quickly get at the various structures but without the timescale information?
Yes, 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 and yes. There's so much room for all these different methods. I think I always say that it takes all types and all kinds. You know, I think it is still important. And I hope I don't give the wrong impression. I mean, it is really important to develop these models for individual molecular piece parts. And there's so much that can be done for each of those in so many different ways from so many dimensions, with atoms or without atoms, you know, different methods, as Amarda also mentioned, all of which, you know, have the potential to play an important role in sort of catalyzing discovery and scientific knowledge around these targets. I do also believe, however, that, and I hope that our work will show that we need to do more than just look at each individual component, valuable as that is, but to also understand how these components come together into the working whole, and to try to understand also sort of emergent behavior. And there will be, you know, which is very difficult, and will take different types of not only experimental methods, but also simulation methods, different types of physics as you go across these different scales. I mean, even, you know, there's always like, I sort of liken it to like using a different lens. You know, you have these microscopes and you can change the lenses sort of depending on what you need to see or want to see, or the questions you're asking, you change the lenses. That's just like it is with changing these different methods. I'm also really excited, of course, about the application of AI, the intersection of AI, together with the experiments and the simulation, and sort of the, because of the breadth of the studies that have been done now on so many of the targets in SARS-CoV-2, I think it's going to be, it has the potential, in my opinion, to be like a really great sort of driving use case for AI technology going forward. But we're going to have to see how that plays out.
Okay, so we are tag teaming the questions, Rumi.
Okay, great.
From Daniel Cox, have you focused on the furin binding domain, which apparently also fluctuates substantially and thus is unresolved by cryo-EM?
Yes, that darn furin loop. There have been so many structures of the spike protein. They have resolved pretty much every loop on it by now, except for that one, which is very tricky and very interesting. We, you know, we're working on a lot of things with this protein. We aren't right. I have to say, to be completely honest with you, we don't have a focused furin loop study, but we're touching on it and contacting it sort of in different ways, trying to understand the dynamics of that area and how it might be correlated to other events. But it is certainly one where there is a lot of interest, and I think molecular simulation potentially has a lot to give because of the difficulties in determining high resolution structures for that flexible region. I wish I had like a yes, oh, we're also doing this. I don't for that particular area, but I hope that someone does.
The next question is from Miranda Lynch. She's asking, why would the glycan additions be so consistent and specific? Is there variability in the added glycan unit at a given glycosylation site?
Great question. Yes. So the glycans do have they do vary. You know, they call this micro heterogeneity. Different sites on the spike protein will have differing degrees of micro heterogeneity. Interestingly, the glycans at, for example, position 234, which I showed you at the beginning and which we hypothesized were playing a role in the mechanism. That particular glycan is pretty well conserved. It's either a MAN 8 or a MAN 9 glycan, they call it. And that was another clue to us that the conservation of that glycan type, and also it's a little bit of a, in some sense, an unusual type, that it was an indication that maybe something else, that it was also, you know, potentially doing something. I would say too, so this, I just want to make another comment on glycan microheterogeneity. So it is important. It's harder for us, people like me, you know, to molecular simulators to get a really comprehensive picture of microheterogeneity because of the combinatorial explosion. If you try to, you know, generate every single type of combination, you know, you have way too many models and it's just computationally intractable. But I will also say that that's the other reason why I think it's really important that we have multiple groups developing models of the spike. So I'm not the only person studying the spike. And every group that builds the spike protein, they tend to just naturally maybe have made a slightly different choice in terms of the composition of the glycans at a particular site, even abiding by what we know from glycomics. You know, there can be varying degrees of microheterogeneity. And so this is another reason why I made that comment about the AI at the end, because, you know, we're assembling as a worldwide community, a database essentially of a lot of these variations. And, you know, with new methods, analysis methods, we should be able to develop a better understanding of sort of what are the impacts of the microheterogeneity on the structural dynamics and potentially the mechanism and function of these proteins, but it's going to take somebody to sort of like do a meta level analysis, you know, of all of these. I hope that answered your question.
Okay, so the next question is from Ken Chong. How can the current vaccines be quickly modified for the UK and South Africa viruses?
So what they can do is they can modify the spike construct. So first of all, the UK strain, I think, has been shown to be like, I think it's fairly okay with the vaccines, that there's just like really not too much of a hit to their efficacy. The South Africa strain is a little bit more concerning. And even Moderna just yesterday announced that they have an update to the vaccine. So what they can do is just, these sort of variants of concern or these mutations, it's like the spike protein will, you know, mutate parts of itself to do a couple of different things. Generally, these mutations, they sort of give it some kind of gain of fitness as it's circulating. In the case of the South Africa strain, there's a mutation or two mutations in that receptor binding domain that I told you about. And these mutations make that handshake with ACE2 even stronger. And so that's one of the reasons why it's sort of like it has optimized even more sort of this contact. And so what they can do is they can actually change, I believe what they do is they just change like the mRNA that they're putting into the vaccine. They can make it so that it's actually mimicking the one that's circulating. But what we need to do is, you know, what we hope to do really is get global vaccine, you know, vaccines around the world globally as quickly as possible so that we can, you know, reduce the levels of circulating viruses and keep that mutation down. That's going to be like a really big global effort.
The next question has to do with different open conformers and how do the simulations capture them. So single, double, triple open states, does the molecular dynamics work indicate the percent occupancy of those different open states? And is there a preference of different open conformers for engaging the ACE2?
That's a great question, and there's a lot of us working on it still. We have only seen, in all the simulations that we've done, we've only seen the opening of the one, and we've seen, the other thing is not only does it open, but the whole, they call it the S1 subunit, it actually kind of has to peel off. And then it's like, there are questions around, you know, so once that guy is up, and then once it starts to peel off, is it easier for the other S, you know, other RBDs to open? Our work has not revealed that yet, although I'm sure that that probably will be coming down the road. It is interesting because, you know, the spike protein, I mean, one of the parts that's like so fascinating, which I really didn't do it justice, but it really is a spring-loaded molecular machine. It is... If you look at its structure, I mean, it's just so amazing how all these pieces come together. And it's right at this margin, at this border of being stable and unstable, such that you have these relatively small changes. And then all of a sudden, something massive, you know, there's a really like a massive conformational change that it goes from like the pre to the post-fusion states. And sort of, you know, it's just amazing to me how these microscopic changes, something as simple as like a single amino acid mutation can completely shift the landscape of this protein. And these are the kinds of things that, yes, molecular simulation can inform on, but, you know, there's just still a lot to be done. And I'll just underscore that too. I mean, not to get too biological about it, but, you know, one of the big discoveries of this protein that came years ago was actually this so-called 2P mutation, you know, which maybe some of you have heard about, but this was largely the work of Jason McClelland working on the MERS protein, the sort of sister or relative to this SARS-CoV-2, where, you know, they were trying to get the protein to express better and so that they could characterize the pre-fusion state structurally. And they realized that they could make a 2-proline mutate, they could mutate some residues to proline at the tip of this sort of central helices. And that was a complete game changer. This small modification stabilized to a dramatic effect the pre-fusion state. You know, changes the expression, makes it much more experimentally tractable to work with, but it also changes the amount of the RBDs that are in the upstate. And this is why the vaccines turned out to be so effective. Because if you just put in the wild type spike, you have a particular, like you're saying, ensemble of up and down states. But when they made that 2P mutation, they shifted that conformation to having mostly the one upstate. And that's why this 2P spike construct that's in the Moderna vaccine, that's in the Pfizer vaccine, that's in every vaccine except for AstraZeneca with a 2P, it was much better at getting a response from the human immune system. And it was because that one, the tiny mutations basically shifted it to a more exposed state. Anyway, so yeah. We're trying to, with others, you know, really understand what are all these sort of details of the molecular mechanism.
Wonderful, thank you. From another attendee, can you discuss the error margins in your simulations? Computer scientist, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, so we characterize error in different ways, depending sort of on what we look at. So I'm not sure exactly, but like one way that we care, you know, we often look at sort of deviation from the mean. So a lot of what we're looking at is like statistical, we're looking at sort of like, what are the statistics of populations of the upstate or some kind of what's the variance in dynamics in terms of, which we always have to sort of define in some way. So maybe it's like, I didn't show you this, but there's when we characterize the dynamics coming out of our system, we're looking for sort of like predominant motions. It's not just that you see like one thing, you see sort of like distributions of motions. And so you characterize in that sense, well, that's not error, that's more like maybe the results. So maybe I need to think more carefully about how I can succinctly reply to how we characterize error. But in general, we do it by trying to benchmark back to what is known experimentally. Yeah, there's sort of like, it comes in, quantification of error from molecular simulation comes into play in many different ways. From the molecular dynamics engine itself, all the way through to development of force fields, which I didn't talk about, but they're like part of the ingredients that we need to run these simulations. And then also how we sort of like analyze the data. So it comes into play actually in many different ways.
Okay, thank you. Next question is from Yaroslav Majewski. He would like to know about rigidity of the S protein. So why is it so rigid and always sticking at 90 degrees from the surface of the membrane? One would expect a lot of bending. Changes in orientation vis-a-vis the surface or the virus surface?
It does move. It's just that the pictures that you see, they're only showing you one thing. So this is like, you know, you strike to my heart with this question, because that's how it is, that we see something and then we sort of imprint that that's how it is everywhere when it's absolutely not. So, you see this pretty image of this tidy standing very slow, like a little soldier spike protein. That's not at all the case. It bends like crazy. It bends, it has all sorts of angles, you know, sort of like I showed you with the stalk. And they know from cryo-ET, if they look at, so the reason why we sort of depict it like straight up and down is just because the cryo-electron microscopist, the single particle people, you know, they get the head and then it's like, it's just, they just see this average blob and it's, you know, it's just, they orient it in a certain way and then the rest is history. But if you look at the cryo-electron tomography, which gives us like many pictures of the spike on the surface of the virus, as soon as you start to assemble those, you realize, oh, this guy has major hinges and it can, you know, it can lean quite far over. And that's not only, it carries through for every single protein that like we've ever studied since like the beginning of time. And it's definitely the case with the viral proteins too. Just like I showed you for ACE2. ACE2, if you look at that cryo-electron microscopy study, you see it standing very upright and okay, it's ready to go. But actually it's waving around and it goes almost literally nearly like flat to the membrane and then it can go back and forth. And these sorts of properties, as you know, suggest, they're important for sort of like the mechanics of membrane fusion, that it has these different hinge points and that allows for binding and contact, yet flexibility and bringing those two membranes close at the end for fusion. And so it's all part of their mechanism. It's just, we're only now getting insights into how these things actually move.
So I think we have a related question from Miranda Lynch, but I'll pose it just to make sure. Can the simulation work on the viral membrane be modeled to capture the types of curvature changes that would be important in viral budding or infusion with the host membrane?
Yes, we can. It's just, I will say that's a place where coarse graining has a lot to give. Like the work of Greg Voth, he's done a lot of good things in that area with like looking at HIV virus type budding and assembly. So we can do it, and we can get the curvature. So I show, you know, like with influenza, it's like all these things, they're not actually really spherical. They're sort of like mostly spherical, but they're, you know, they're not. And sometimes they can be filamentous and stuff. It's just that for our methods, because we're carrying around all the details of the atoms, which is wonderful for things, for questions about mechanism for chemistry, you know, if you want to understand how to design new chemical matter that could affect biological function, you need the atoms, let's face it. But, you know, if you want to look at more longer scale properties, larger length scales, longer time scales, then, you know, methods like coarse graining, which can link to our structures, but then they reduce the resolution, allow for longer time stepping, and thus can sort of get out towards longer time scales of fusion and also, you know, of budding. That will come. And I think I'm really one of the also sort of silver linings is, in general, for the type of work that we do, we are really reliant on good experimental data to like give us checkpoints, you know, for what we're simulating, like sanity checks, testing of hypotheses. But like with SARS-CoV-2, now there's so many good data sets. And I think it's going to allow for like an acceleration of methods development and scientific understanding. You know, it's going to be, you know, focused here because this is where the data is, but I'm sort of excited for that.
Thank you. Next question has to do with vaccine testing. It's from Ken Wang. He would like to know, can molecular simulation contribute to increasing the efficiency of vaccine testing and evaluation? So for example, not creating the conditions for testing in the population?
Oh, that's a really good question. That one goes beyond my pay grade. we're going to try to use molecular simulation to design like a broadly to sort of help in the efforts to make a broadly neutralizing coronavirus, like pan coronavirus vaccine, but that's like on the development side. In terms of clinical trials, I would guess that it's going to be mostly about like understanding maybe the genetics of the populations and making sure that it's like broadly distributed and stuff like that. But I actually, that one I should stay in my lane. Sorry. Which is to say, I'm sure there's probably something that could be done, but it wouldn't be like necessarily, I don't think, with molecular simulation, but I mean, I'm sure computational methods in general.
So the next one is a bit of a comment, but I wondered if you would just take a few minutes to reflect on it. Okay. From Miranda Lynch again, absolutely beautiful work and talk, and it is wonderful to hear about the value of and commitment to open data, open source code, and creating an open computing community. Romy, I know you talked about this in your talk, but do you want to linger a few minutes and just think a little more out loud about the importance of open science and the open communities in which you have engaged and to which you contribute and from which you have benefited?
Oh, sure. I mean, because it's one of my favorite things to talk about because it just makes me feel so good, you know. So I'll just say, it's been a very special time. I think that it's been particularly good. So, I mean, one of the things about this pandemic has been that it has, you know, really, it's sort of like when you get in these situations, it shines lights, right? So it's like, it's shined the light on what we do well. It exposed strengths, but it also exposed weaknesses. And I think for science, you know, I'm hoping that in molecular simulation, I'm really hoping that some of these things stick around because, you know, I'll tell you in general, even after we get the big paper and we still don't share our methods. We still don't share our system files. We don't share our trajectories. You know, I think that this is really helping to change that. That's something that in small segments of the community, people have been talking about for years. We need to share these things. We need to be open about it because, you know, for reproducibility, for training, and for like the future discovery, for building on these initial models, it's so important no matter what area of science it's run. And we've been reluctant to do that. And, you know, it's funny. I don't know. For molecular simulation, I think it's a couple of things like why we haven't shared. One is actually, to be honest, like, so our weighted ensemble trajectories, they're 200 terabytes. It's not easy to share 200 terabytes of data. Like there's, it's like a complication. It's like a bit of a complicated thing. It takes some thought, especially if you're just like, if you're a small research group, you know, how do you maintain that other people have access to this? And the system is not really set up. The journals don't take care of it for you. You know, so it's like, we have to sort of change how we're doing it. The creation that the sort of molecular structure and therapeutics hub that MOLSI started, I think was fantastic and a really great sort of step in this direction. And it catalyzed a lot of discussion among us about what's the metadata that we need to provide with simulation, and like, how do we, if hundreds of groups around the world are actually putting in these data sets, like how do we judge what's good or what's bad? Or, you know, a lot of those conversations which need to happen, which often don't happen because we're so busy talking about other things, you know, they're starting to happen now. And I think that's going to be very good for the field. So I'm looking forward to that carrying forward. And then of course, just, you know, the whole international aspect effort of it, which has just been fantastic. So I think that, you know, and sort of like the move to remote, like I've participated, I was saying, I think before the pod, given so many seminars and in so many places all around the world that I never would have been able to fly by plane to all these places, just logistically never could have happened. But it's like, we can have these conversations and I can have, you know, research lab meetings with people in the UK or in Spain or wherever. And, you know, it's much easier. So hopefully these types of open, you know, this, hopefully that will be one of the good things that sort of sticks around after the pandemic to some extent.
Yes, indeed. Second question from Ken Wang. How can genomic and molecular work combine to anticipate the likely space of future mutants?
Yes. Well, I mean, there hopefully are, you know, I mean, one can imagine being much better at predicting which strains are going to be the ones that actually circulate. And this is the kind of thing that's important, not just for SARS-CoV-2 and future mutations, but for things like influenza and for like many diseases, you know. But there's lots of things that we have yet to understand, you know, like, for example, why, you know, all of these pandemic diseases basically come from animal reservoirs at some point. So understanding that switch, that species switching, is also very important. And that's sort of, again, more basic science, but like, if we know more about those mechanisms, if we can really begin to understand where are those important tipping points, then that hopefully will, you know, with just by genomic surveillance could make a flag or like an alert, like, okay, you're getting, this is getting sort of, seems like it might be getting, you know, to something that we need to be more concerned about. And that could be either for the current disease as it's circulating or for, you know, anticipating future pandemics, whatever they may be.
So Romy, you've had a long day. And you get to work even harder when we invite you back to visit with our colleagues at the NSF at 4 o'clock. So although we do still have some questions that we'll share with you and perhaps you would like to address them when you come back with us at 4, I think we had to give you a break. And thank you for all that you've shared with us today and for all that you do every day. So please, everyone, virtual.
That's great. Thank you so much. Will I lose these questions? I was just thinking I should try to.
No, we'll capture them for you.
Okay, that would be great because I don't know how many screenshots I can do. Okay, good, good.
No, I'm going to rely on MEMS to work their magic.
Okay, thanks. Hi, Lynn. I'm sorry. Of course, you're part of NPS.
No, that's right, great.
Sorry. I didn't know that.
And we have a chemistry questions waiting for you at 4. So.
Oh, good, good, good.
I think good. A good
break. Wonderful.
Yeah, it's a wonderful presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan, I see you're still on. Anything you want to say?
No, just it was a fascinating talk, Romy. Very much. Thank you, Amy, for having given this for us.
Thank you for the
pleasure. Thank you.
So I will see you at 4 o'clock too.
See you at 4. And I think Blaine or Michelle, if you could capture the questions for us, I'd be grateful.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Just got to know. Everybody be well, be safe.